McGrath. Coming up on 10 past 8, The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. Now reopened for in-store shopping on Tuesday, Thursday, and Friday, 11 to 5, Saturdays from 10 to 4. And don't forget your mask. And you can still shop online at jackanddrea.com. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have been devoting a fair amount of time on the morning show to issues related to race and racism. And of course, given recent events here in Kenosha, it has been especially important to have some of these conversations, some of which are not particularly easy, but which are helping all of us to kind of better understand some of the dynamics that are at play, including some of the dynamics that perhaps escape our notice. I am very appreciative of a new book that I've been reading entitled Black Fatigue, How Racism Erodes the Mind, Body, and Spirit. The author of the book is Mary Frances Winters, and she is the founder and president of the Winters Group, a diversity, equity, and inclusion consulting firm. So she is in the business of helping people, in a sense, understand the presence of systemic racism, and particularly the ways in which sometimes racism is at play just below the surface. In this particular book, she's really focusing on the toll that such racism takes on blacks who experience it in their professional lives, in their personal lives, in their day-to-day lives. And again, this is something that is eye-opening, even if it might also be sometimes difficult to take in. The book is published by Barrett Kohler. Again, it's titled Black Fatigue, How Racism Erodes the Mind, Body, and Spirit. Mary Frances Winters, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you for having me.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. I appreciate the fact that while the book in many respects is vast in its scope, it's also a book in which you are not afraid to be personal in terms of sharing your own experience. And I'm anxious to talk about that. But first, I want to ask who you wrote this book for. I mean, when you sat down to write it, I'm sure perhaps you had a wide array of potential readers in mind, but I suspect at the heart of this book you have somebody in mind for whom you think this book can be particularly valuable. Who?
Thank you for that question, because the publisher asked that very question when I conceived the idea about a year ago and started to talk about the book. And they said, well, it's for black people, right? I said, no, we know we're fatigued. It's for white people to support, and those who want to be allies, those who want to, I wanted to understand better what the toll is like. So now, you know, a year later, I think it is for black people to affirm and confirm, and also new information about the relationship between racism and health outcomes, and also for white people who, as we know now, many claim that they didn't know that racism was still such an issue in our society as a result of these most recent protests, people are saying, gee, I didn't know. And as you probably know, many organizations are vowing now to really focus on anti-racism. So it's for those people who also want to have a better understanding of how racism plays out on a day-to-day basis.
Let's get personal for a moment. I want to have you share some of what you share in the first book, first chapter of the book, which is titled My Black Fatigue. And one of the lines that leapt out at me as I read the first chapter was, "My black fatigue started when I was 5 years old." And at some point a little later, you say, "From the time I was five, being black meant being on guard." Tell us about some of your first experiences with black fatigue, experiences which you had as a small youngster.
And it's interesting, yes, when I was 5 years old, I was in kindergarten, Niagara Falls, New York, and a little white boy called me the N-word. I didn't really know what that meant because we didn't use that kind of language in my household. So when I went home and talked to my parents and they told me, it took me from being this sort of carefree little five-year-old, the world is mine, I can do whatever I want, to being very cautious and on guard because somebody might not like me because of the color of my skin. And as a five-year-old, think about a five-year-old trying to process that. You know, I'd never taken a psychology course. Of course, I didn't know anything about that at 5 years old. I just knew that now somebody might not like me. And so it took me from being very open to be very cautious. And what's interesting in the trainings that I do, because my company does a lot of diversity, equity, and inclusion training, and when I'm with people and we ask the question, when did you first notice or recognize race? Many people said that their first experience was at 5 years old or very early on in elementary school. So that is not a unique experience. And let's think about that, that collective experience of being told or somehow having your world shaken, that you are different at that young age. Let's just think about how that impacts people, impacts children and changes them from that moment on.
Right.
So it's really very serious when we think about it, and it leads to what we call internalized racism when you begin to believe some of those negative stereotypes about your group.
Right. When I read that story and hearing you recount it now, it's interesting. It gets me thinking about all of this in a little different way, and that is when you say, I suddenly realize somebody didn't like me because of the color of my skin. And that really gets at the heart of what we call hate crimes, the fact that this little boy wasn't expressing his dislike of you, perhaps even on some level hatred of you, if that's possible for a five-year-old, I don't know, but it was because of the color of your skin, something that you cannot change. I mean, it wasn't that he didn't like you because, you know, you were stuck up or you were or you didn't smell good or he didn't like the way you did your hair. It was because of something that you cannot change about yourself, in the same way that when somebody expresses hatred of somebody because of, for instance, their sexual orientation, expressing hatred about a quality that person cannot change. I think to experience hatred because of that kind of characteristic, that has to be especially scary, because what are you as a five-year-old little girl going to do about the color of your skin? There's nothing you can do.
Yeah, absolutely. And that visible characteristic that people see, you know, for example, other identities that are marginalized, you know, such as religion, we oftentimes can't see someone's religion. Sometimes we can, because they may, you know, dress in a particular way that denotes their religion. Even sexual orientation, you can't always see just at first glance, right? And so race is one, you know, gender or sex would be another one that you can usually see. And so it is more severe, if you will, because it's right there. I can remember in the 80s being in New York City a lot for business, and if I was traveling with an African-American male, he would say, and we needed a cab, you know, back then. That was before Uber and Lyft, right? And he'd say, you go out and, you know, get the cab because he knew that cabs would not stop for, you know, a black man. And so, again, your physical identity that is visible that creates the disparate and racist treatment.
One thing that you point out in the book is, you say it in these words, I live at the intersection of blackness and womanhood. And I wonder if you could just kind of take that apart for us a little bit, because there are certain indignities that you have suffered because of your race and others that you have suffered because you are a woman. And I wonder, you know, first of all, what is it like to experience both of those, and how do you sort out, in a sense, which is which? I should think that is a bit of a complication here.
It is indeed a bit of a complication, and the notion of intersectionality, that our intersections of our intersecting identities compound our black fatigue. Sometimes you don't know if the treatment is because I'm of my gender, because I'm a woman. Is it because I'm black? But we can put those two together, and we can look at stereotypes, and we can look at behaviors that happen as a result of both. So there are, white women do not experience the same things that black women experience. And so women, as a group, do experience misogyny. They do experience, sexism, to a great extent. However, as black women, it's even worse. You look at socioeconomic outcomes as an example for black women and white women, and they are very different. In the workplace, a black woman is oftentimes seen as angry, the angry black woman, that the passion is expressed as anger. White women are not usually seen as angry. They may be seen as perhaps, too assertive. And also the data shows that children, let's look at children, that black girls are adultified. There's an adultification that goes on. And so black girls are not seen as needing as much nurturing and protection as white girls are seen to be, little kids, and they need to be nurtured. So black girls are seen as older. So we have to look at the compounding of different identities and how they play out differently. And that oftentimes does create a tension in the workplace. It creates a tension. Well, let's just look at all women. Let's look at all blacks. No, because the experiences of black men are going to be different than the experiences of black women. Black men are often seen as a threat. Black women are not necessarily. So we do have to break apart those identities and look at how the compounding identities, play out and intersect to create experiences that are fatiguing.
We're speaking with Mary Frances Winters, and we're talking with her about her book called Black Fatigue: How Racism Erodes the Mind, Body, and Spirit. It actually is probably time for us to take apart that term, and I want to explore some other terms with you as well. But let's begin with black fatigue. First of all, I'm trying to remember if this is a term that you yourself have coined, or if this is a term that has been around for a while. Tell us more about what is behind those two words.
Yeah, I think I've coined it. I'm not sure. When I did my research, there was an academia a number of years ago, back in the 80s, had coined the term black battle fatigue. And it was about students in university and how black students were navigating differently. And there was a fatigue about being accepted in university. So, but I think black fatigue is one that I have coined. And really what I mean by it is that it's the compounding experiences that we have on a day-to-day basis over and over and over again that create this malaise and this, just this tiredness that we often don't even recognize. And so I have defined black fatigue as repeated variations of stress that result in extreme exhaustion and cause mental, physical, and spiritual maladies that are passed down from generation to generation. Scientists are now finding that the stress caused by living while black creates something in the cellular system. The chemicals that are caused by stress get embedded into one cellular system and are passed down from generation to generation. It's a branch of science that's known as epigenetics. And so that's what I mean when I say black fatigue. It's enduring. It's always there. And I've defined it for myself as something that's like this drone. It's always kind of just there under the surface. And I try to drown it out by my optimism and my hope. And you see that with the black community, that there is always this sense of hope, this sense of optimism, this sense of positivity. Black joy, or we talk about black girl magic, and we talk about, staying positive and staying above that. However, what I wanted to highlight is the real manifestation and the impact of having to live on guard, having to live in fear, having to live in a society that still characterizes black people as less than. The idea that we have to work twice as hard to get half as far, the idea that we have to be careful about what we say, how we say it, all of those things create an additional burden, an additional toll, and that is what black fatigue is.
As I hear that explanation, I feel like I already know how you're going to answer this next question, which is, how widespread would you say this is, this condition of black fatigue? Is this something that to varying degrees every single black person in America experiences? Or are there at least a few blacks who, in a sense, do not need to live their lives with this kind of burden of black fatigue? Or to some extent, do you really feel like this is a significant presence in the life of every single black person?
Well, I don't know about every single black person because, we're not a monolith, and so everybody is different. I do know that when I was contemplating writing this book, and I said to colleagues and friends that I was thinking about it, to a person, they said, oh, please write it. Oh, yes. And as I look at what's going on, the conversations going on social media as a result of me publishing this book, I'm seeing that people are saying, I so needed this. I so needed this. But the impetus for me to write this book actually came from, I'm a baby boomer, I've been around for a while, actually came from millennials and Gen Zs in the workplaces. I was going into those workplaces. I was hearing, we're exhausted. We're just really tired of continuing to fight this battle in the workplace, continuing to, not see the promotions, continuing to have the microaggressions on a daily basis. They said, we're just tired. We're exhausted. And I would say, well, you're 35 years old. How are you exhausted already? I can be exhausted, as old as I am. But they would look at me and say, we're exhausted. And so that's when I started to study the impact on the emotional toll as a result of the recent protests. Many organizations have been conducting listening sessions with their black employees to actually hear, what are they saying? What are the, what is the experience in the company? And so I could just take the name of any company off of my report and slap the name of the next company because the words that are used, the sentiments are exactly, the same. We feel isolated. We know we are seen as a threat. We are not given credit for the work that we do, the sense that we have to work twice as hard. All of those sentiments came out again and again from companies that were high-tech companies to healthcare companies. I can't name, my clients because I signed confidentiality agreements. But the issues and the concerns and the sense of black fatigue was the same over and over and over again.
Let's explore some other terms that are also part of this book and that in a sense help kind of set the stage for what we are talking about. In a sense, at the other end of black fatigue is the phenomenon of white privilege. And I think this is actually one of the most difficult concepts to get people to understand, and for that matter, to get people to accept, particularly if one is a white person and struggling in life. I mean, not all white people live in mansions and have yachts. I mean, there are plenty of whites who, for whom life is a terrible struggle in one way or another. And yet there is this thing called white privilege that would seem to encompass all whites of all backgrounds. I think you do a very good job in your book of defining what you mean by white privilege. Let's begin with that. What is your notion of what white privilege is and how it plays out, especially beyond the obvious?
Yeah, so I think what happens is that people think of this as a binary, that you either have privilege or you don't. I think about privilege as that we all have privilege in some aspect of our lives. When we talk, when white people will say, for example, well, I grew up poor, and I'm on the lower end of the socioeconomic scale, so I certainly don't have privilege. Well, perhaps you don't have socioeconomic privilege, but indeed you have privilege based on the color of your skin, because we know that through research that white people are given the benefit of the doubt more often. We know that white people have access, easier access for loans, easier access to other to promotions in organizations. We know that just by the data. We say that equity will happen when we can no longer predict outcomes by one's identity. Well, we can still predict outcomes by one's racial identity. So that is what white privilege is all about. It doesn't mean that you have necessarily education privilege or privilege in other aspects of your life, but studies show that poor white people are much better off financially. When I say financially, I mean from the perspective of having access to those things that we need than poor black people. For example, we talk about food deserts, and we talk about the fact that grocery stores do not locate, big chains do not locate in neighborhoods where black and brown people live. In fact, that's not the case for poor white people. So poor white people have that access. We also know that from a health perspective, black women, middle class black women who have access to health care are still twice as likely to have preterm births as poor white women. And so you can control for socioeconomics and still see the disparities between blacks and whites. And so white privilege, therefore, is the privilege afforded to you based on the visible color of your skin. We also know that there's a racial hierarchy. So the lighter your skin, even for black people, the lighter your skin, the more privilege you have, the closer you are to white. In my book, I talk about the fact that studies have shown that dark-skinned black men make less money than light-skinned black men in the same role. That's just one study, but there are many studies. So colorism, you know, is an issue and creates that particular hierarchy. So outcomes are different based on the color of your skin. That's what white privilege is.
Interesting. And so there, for certain, is this thing called white privilege, but the degree to which it plays out in a given person's life can be vastly different, and maybe that's a distinction that needs to be part of the conversation when we start talking about white privilege. Because I think, like a lot of terms, it's a term that can very easily be used carelessly or thoughtlessly.
Yeah, and that's what I try to do in my book. You know, create an understanding of, you know, what we mean when we talk about, you know, white privilege. It's basically based on your race that you have privilege. You may not have privilege, like I say, in other aspects of your life, but your white skin in a society where white is considered supreme, superior, if you will, white supremacy. It's considered supreme or better. We saw that throughout our history, throughout the world history, colonization and imperialism and whatnot. So throughout the world, white is considered the better race. And that's what we're talking about. So just by sheer fact that you carry and you identify and your skin is white creates this privilege, if you will.
Right.
It's privilege. Yeah.
Yeah, I think what you were just saying makes me think of when you live in a country where it feels like whites are kind of the predominant race or the kind of the normal race or the it's the ordinary thing to be white. And if you're some other race, I mean, one might not consciously think you're less than me, but you're somebody other than me. You're other than the mainstream. You're and in some respects sort of peripheral to who we are. As Americans, you're not part of the we. And even that in and of itself, on some level, is a form of white privilege.
Exactly. The dominant group versus what we call the subordinated groups. And so dominant doesn't necessarily mean the majority. So think of apartheid South Africa. Black South Africans were in the majority, but whites were the dominant group and those that were in power. So that's how we think about dominant. It's those who are in power, those who set the rules, and the others are supposed to abide by those rules, that there's only one way to do it, and this is our way. And so the othering, just by sheer fact that there is this distinction between dominant and subordinated, the subordinated groups are the not normal, as you were saying. It's just, and that may just be an unconscious way that we think about it, but that's how it plays out in actuality.
Right.
That's how it plays out.
Let's unpack the term white supremacy, which you say is a term that is really misunderstood. And you say that most of us, and I would count myself among them, when I hear those terms, I think about the Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazis and white supremacists in which there is an overt hatred of blacks and other minorities, which they proudly wear on their sleeves, even if their faces might be hooded. But there is something unmistakable about it. And you actually tell us that white supremacy is something that sometimes lives beneath the surface in ways that are really frightening. Help us understand the wider array of possibilities of white supremacy being lived out.
Thank you. Yeah, we don't like to use that word. We don't like to talk about it because we think that it is reserved for those hate groups because that's how it's typically used. However, it's the real broad definition is that it's an ideology, whether conscious or unconscious. Explicit or implied, that white people and their ideas, thoughts, beliefs, and actions are superior to people of color and their ideas, thoughts, and beliefs of action. We see it in the structural, racism that is just rampant and continues to be rampant even after 400 years in this country. White supremacy, can be demonstrated, as heterosexual white male supremacy, organizational cultures that are built, on capitalism, individualism, those kinds of things. All of those kinds of things can are a part of a white supremacy culture. Mm-hmm. It's a male, white, heterosexually dominated culture. And we see this, I don't want to get political. But we see this played out in the politics that we're seeing today. One of the things that we learned over the past few weeks was this executive order that came out about not being able to, or banning the kind of training that my company does because it's seen as anti-American and divisive by this current administration. And so there, in this executive order, it speaks to no race baiting and no stereotyping and no scapegoating where we're blaming, one group over another. That's not what our work is about. But in a white supremacy culture where the rules are made by those who are in the dominant group and those who are the ones who are advantaged by the status quo, they would want to ban the type of learning that would help us understand how this plays out. So that's fatiguing in and of itself, because we have to defend, you know, this unconscious bias training and anti-racism training has been done for many, many years, but there's a resurgence right now of interest in it as a result of the protest. And the order comes out to say, you can't do that because you're shaming and blaming white people. It's not about shaming, again, the dominant group. We can't hear this. It's not about shaming and blaming white people. It is about articulating and understanding the history that has caused the inequities and also why we are having protests right now. So a lot of my clients at the Winters Group want to understand. They say, wow, you know, we didn't know things were so bad. Help us to understand. And so many of them are saying, we didn't know the history because the history is not told accurately in the history books. Well, it's just, you know, pretty much left out of the history books. And so people who are wanting to be allies, who are wanting to really get underneath the systemic racism and do something about it, are listening. And they want to hear. They want to learn. They want us to help to understand what does white supremacy, you know, really look like as it plays out in organizations. We're not calling people, you know, racist or, you know, horrible, you know, people who are white supremacists. We're saying it's a culture. And so we have to come up, get away from this individual, like I'm attacking an individual. We're not attacking an individual at all. We're attacking a system that continues to divide us and polarize us.
Right.
And keep us from all being equal.
At one point in this chapter, you say white supremacy means that white ideals are the norm. And by default,
correct,
every other group's beliefs are in some way abnormal. We're speaking,
correct,
with Mary Frances Winters. We're exploring her book called Black Fatigue, How Racism Erodes the Mind, Body, and Spirit. So you take us also into a deeper understanding of racism versus non-racism versus something that you call anti-racism. And I think this is a very important point to make at this point in our nation's history. The idea that I think in your view, it is not enough to just not be a racist, which is probably what many, many white people would say at this moment. I know there are racists. I don't think I'm one of them. I hope I'm not one of them. But even if that is true, just being not a racist is really not enough. That is not what this current situation calls for. Explain the step beyond non-racism.
So non-racism is someone who might just say, you know, hey, I'm just not a racist, and that's it. You know, live and let live. I don't do anything about it. And an anti-racist is somebody who is actively working to dismantle, to combat racism, someone who recognizes it, is willing to speak up about it, is willing to, in a corporation, not afraid to be an ally and to speak up about things that are inequitable. You know, it could be something as small as, well, as you say small, but something like, you know, so why wasn't Mary Frances invited to that, to this meeting? Oh, we just forgot her. I was on a Zoom call recently with a client, and everybody was introducing themselves. And the way that I had them introduce themselves is I said, okay, you introduce yourself, and then you select the next person to introduce themselves, just to make things go faster. You pick the next person. Well, everybody was picked. There was only one black man on the whole call. This is a leadership group. There's only one black man on the whole call, and he was forgotten. He was not picked. Nobody picked him, and, you know, he went last. So that's an example of where somebody could have been more in tune and really watching what was going on and saying, hey, you know, we left, I forgot his name, but I wouldn't say his name anyway, we left Charlie out. So those are the kinds of things, those small things every single day that we can do to notice, to speak up, to stand in for. So again, for the black fatigue, so that it's not always the black person who has to say, hey, wait a minute. You know, this is not fair, or hey, wait a minute, you know, I should be included in this. And so that's what an anti-racist is. I want to also point out that there are some theorists and sociologists who believe that because we live in a racialized world, a world where there is a racial hierarchy, that we all contribute to that racialized world because we've been conditioned, you know, to do so. So in some respect, if you look at it from that broad definition, we're all racists, right? Because we live in a racialized world. Doesn't mean we're bad people. It means that we are products of this world that has a racial hierarchy.
Right. At one point, actually, your book even takes up briefly, albeit, the question of whether a black person can be racist. And you tell us it's kind of a complicated question with a complicated answer, but the answers are both yes and no. But your book really spells out some very interesting thoughts here. Also, Speaking of definitions, you tell us about a distinction that I think is probably lost on many of us between equity and equality. Tell us why you think it is important for us to properly understand these two terms.
Yeah, so equality is about treating everybody the same. Equity is about giving people what they need. So some of the listeners may be familiar with a cartoon that shows three children trying to see over a fence to a baseball game. And the children are different sizes. Each child is given the same size box to see over the fence. The tallest child didn't need a box at all. The middle-sized child needed one box, and the smallest child needs two boxes. So you are not, in essence, treating everybody the same. You are giving people what they need in order to succeed, and in order to see over the fence. So we have to get beyond, which the Civil Rights Act of 1964 took us to this place where we're all, you know, we're going to treat everybody equally now. Everybody doesn't have the same starting point. And so by treating everybody equally dismisses or ignores the fact that we are starting from different places. We're starting perhaps from deficit positions, and we need to be able to account for that and adjust for that.
Mm. This brings to mind a term that actually I had not heard before, and it comes in the chapter titled Then Is Now, in which you spell out many of the ways in which blacks are perpetually at a disadvantage when it comes to matters like economic equality and access and so on. At some point, you talk about the so-called black tax. And mm-hmm. This is when we are talking about people who are born into a nation with an entrenched racist system that, in a sense, has them starting out at a decidedly disadvantaged position. Tell us more about this notion of the black tax.
Yeah, so the black tax can play out in a number of different ways, but it's the extra economic price that you pay, and it plays out in ways like we pay more for loans because perhaps we don't have the history of having had the credit for a long enough time. We know from data that we pay more in you're going to go to buy a car, we're going to pay more. We're not going to get the same discounts that might be afforded to white people. So the tax is that extra amount of economic exchange, if you will, that is required by black people because of the inequities, because we don't have the history. So let's take, for example, when with the coronavirus and the government was providing the PPE loans, the payroll protection loans. Many small black businesses couldn't even apply for those loans because they didn't have that kind of an established relationship with a bank because the bank has rules that say you have to have this amount of equity, you have to have this amount of this, and many small black businesses did not have that. So that's, you know, that's the tax. That's part of that a concept of the black tax.
You go on to say that there are other factors as well that, in your words, exacerbate the vicious cycle of wealth inequality. And of course, this is the kind of thing that, in a sense, stretches back generations. And it's a key ingredient in this thing called black fatigue. I also want to give you a chance to return to something we've touched on briefly, which is the fact that one of the most important manifestations of this so-called black fatigue comes in the disproportionate level of health difficulties experienced by so many blacks. What are we talking about here?
So, yes, we did talk about that briefly. The new studies are showing that, in fact, racism is the root of many of the health disparities. As a matter of fact, some municipalities have now said that racism is a public health crisis, a public health emergency, if you will. So the studies are showing that the stress, this accumulated stress that gets into our cellular system, manifests as physiological problems such as high blood pressure, such as diabetes, such as being more prone to cancer. And so all of this, these studies that show that black people are disproportionately impacted by, you know, various health conditions, people have in the past said, oh, that's all environmental. And if you just level the playing field relative to socioeconomics, you're not going to continue to see these health issues that are, disproportionate for black people. Well, that is not the case. Even when you control for socioeconomics and access to care, you still see these disparities. And the scientists are now saying that it is due to the stress caused by racism. Hmm.
Your book goes on to explore all kinds of ways in which all of this can play out, including something that I think a lot of us do not yet fully grasp and understand, microaggressions, such as microassaults, microinsults, microinvalidations. Briefly, what is behind those words?
So these can be unconscious types of slights that are made and perhaps not even intentional, but things that are triggering for black people because of the stereotypes. For example, when someone might say, I am so, you are so articulate. You know, they might be saying that in a very positive way, but it might be said with a tone that, and oh, I wasn't really expecting you to be so. I tell the story in the book about one of my colleagues who is a college professor. He was in his first day of his doctoral program, and at the break, two white women came over. He was with another black gentleman in that program, came over to them and said, oh, you're so nice. And all they had said was their name and, you know, perhaps where they were from or what they were studying. And he said, you know, with this characterization of you're so nice when you don't even know me, and the tone that you said it was, you know, I don't know any nice black people. And so those are the kinds of things that you want to, you know, respond. Should I respond? Shouldn't I respond? Again, that creates more stress to not know. You just smile and you take it in. Things like for black women in particular, and this is one that I know that it's kind of universal, you know, can I touch your hair? No, you can't touch my hair. But if I say, you know, no, am I being overly sensitive? They're going to say, I'm not a team player anymore. Oh, gee, I don't like that black girl because look at her. She's got an attitude. Or, you know, again, the angry black woman kind of thing. So there's just a lot of ways. And so in my book, I actually crossed out, as a stylistic thing, I crossed out the word micro because these aggressions are really macro. Another one that that happens a lot is we're mistaken for the other black person. Usually they're, you know, if there's like two black women in the department or on the team or something, you're called by the other's name, which, you know, sort of makes you feel obviously, you know, less than or not important in your own right because, you know, oh yeah, that's the black person. And so you're lumped with another person and not seen as an individual. So those are just a few ways which the microaggressions, play out and can play out in an organization. And most times people are quiet about them because they don't want to be viewed as viewed as overly sensitive, or playing the race card. Oh, you play the race card, right? And that's something that, again, that's a microaggression in and of itself, to say to somebody, don't play the race card, because you don't know how I'm feeling. You're dismissing my feelings, and actually, that's part of the white supremacy as well. You know, the way I'm telling you to feel is how you should feel.
In our closing couple of minutes, I wonder if we could turn our attention to the city of Kenosha, which in the wake of the shooting of Jacob Blake and the widespread demonstrations and some rioting that occurred in the wake of that, this city is trying to come to grips with some very difficult issues, including issues related to race and racism and systemic racism. What would be your advice for those participating in these conversations, and in particular for those white people who are at the heart of many of these conversations that can be so difficult? How would you advise us to proceed in terms of trying to address some of these issues and talking about them in productive ways?
Number one, I would say, do your homework, understand the history, not only in Kenosha, but sort of the broader history of racism in America. Number two, listen. Listen without defense or response. Listen to understand. Number three, reflect, self-reflect on your own background, your own experiences, on what they have been. Reflect on how you perhaps have been complicit in the system. If you feel, shame and blame, work through that for yourself, and move on from that, because we can't stay stuck in that and shame and blame. If you are someone who is white who doesn't feel that your identity is core to who you are, that your white identity is core, Pew Research does a study that asks people, to what extent is your race core to your identity? Only 15% of white people say that it is. 75% of black people say that it is. Can't have cross-racial conversations if only 15% of white people recognize the role of whiteness in these conversations, the role that their whiteness plays in these conversations. And so understand whiteness. You know, books like White Fragility, we talked about that, but there are others. Shannon Sullivan wrote a book. She's a professor at University of North Carolina in Charlotte. She wrote a book called Good White People. I mean, and so there are all sorts of resources to really understand this dynamic that perhaps you haven't really thought about before, because you haven't had, as a dominant group person, you just haven't had to think about it. Hmm.
The book again is Black Fatigue: How Racism Erodes the Mind, Body, and Spirit, published by Barrett Kohler Publishers, the author, Mary Frances Winters. Mary Frances Winters, thank you so much for being part of The Morning Show, and thank you for this opportunity to talk with you about your thought-provoking book. Best wishes.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Brian Albrecht's monthly visit to the program. And with him will be Cheryl Carrier, who is one of the employees at Ford that is overseeing their education outreach arm. On Friday, Luce Brett, author of PMSL, a fascinating and frank and entertaining look, believe it or not, at the struggles that she has had as a middle-aged woman with incontinence, one of the last taboos, one of the topics so hard to discuss. Her book is really quite remarkable. We'll hear that conversation on Friday. Support for the WGTD Morning Show comes from Jack and Drea, Kenosha's home.